Well, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Harry S. Truman Library. We're delighted to have all of you with us today. I'm Mike Devine. I'm director of the library, and it's my distinct privilege to introduce today's program. Before I introduce the program, though, we have a couple of special guests with us today. I'd like to introduce each of them. First, I'd like to introduce the Honorable Don Rimel, the mayor of Independence, Missouri. And a very, very special guest who we're always delighted to have in our building and have with us, former U.S. Representative Ike Skelton, who was also former chairman of the Armed Services Committee. Ike? Just a little bit on logistics. For our question and answer session that will take place later on today, we have a microphone set up on the side over here, which is to my right, your left. And so those who do have questions should come down to the microphone and ask the question from there. Okay, our two special guests today really need no introduction, but since I'm getting paid for this, I have to do something, so I will introduce them. Donald Rumsfeld graduated from Princeton University, and upon his graduation, he served in the United States Navy as a pilot. He was first elected to the U.S. House of Representatives from Illinois in 1962 and served four terms before joining the Nixon administration as head of the Office of Equal Employment Opportunity, as a counselor to the president, and as the U.S. ambassador to the North Atlantic Treaty Organization in Brussels. Secretary Rumsfeld then served as chief of staff under President Gerald R. Ford, and who soon appointed him Secretary of Defense. He again served in that capacity as Secretary of Defense in the administration of President George W. Bush from 2001 to 2006, making him the second longest serving Secretary of Defense in United States history. Following the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001, Secretary Rumsfeld oversaw the U.S.-led invasions that led to the overthrow of the Taliban regime in Afghanistan and the toppling of the Iraq regime of Saddam Hussein. Throughout his extraordinary career, he has been presented with numerous awards and honorary degrees, among his awards, the Presidential Medal of Freedom. He is here with us today to discuss his memoir, Known and Unknown, which traces his career from his first political job on Capitol Hill during the Eisenhower administration to his second tenure as Secretary of Defense under President George W. Bush. Our program today will be moderated by a great friend of the Truman Library, Kansas City's own Steve Kraske. Steve is as I'm sure all of you know, is a Kansas City Star reporter and columnist, and also host of KCUR's Up to Date with Steve Kraske. So please join me in welcoming both Secretary Rumsfeld and Steve Kraske to our program today.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, Mr. Secretary, welcome back to the Truman Library.
Thank you.
I was with you in the spring of 2006 when you were here the last time. Mm-hmm. And when you came here that day, you write in your book that you were really struck by all of the agencies that the Truman administration had set up as a national security apparatus as the Cold War was beginning. And you were struck by how many of those agencies, I'm referring to the World Bank, NATO, the UN, are still with us today. And what you wrote about that day as you reflected on it was this idea that with the world in a very new place, you thought it was time to reorganize, rejigger the national security apparatus of the country. And you wrote the president a very long memo about all this. What'd you say? What'd you want to do? And how did he react to it?
Well, first let me say I'm delighted to be back at the Truman Library, and I hope that those of you who support
Mike Mike check. Donald Rumsfeld. Donald Rumsfeld. Turn yourself.
have any water. Maybe
no, no. Let me get some water.
I'm turning myself in.
Go to the Soviet Union. We fucking do what you're doing right now. For goodness sakes.
John? I suspect there are a couple more in here. We'll probably hear from them later. I think we count that last lady as undecided. Well, I'll give it a try to respond to the question, and I am very pleased to be back at the library, and those that of you here who support the library, I congratulate you for it. I think these are important institutions, and they help people better understand our history and the wonderful free system we have in this country. So I thank you all for that. Also want to say hello to Ike Skelton. Where are you, Ike? There you are. Oh, we served in Congress together, and he was a lot more than simply chairman of the Armed Services Committee. He was an outstanding legislator. What was the question went to a memorandum I sent the president, and it's on my website. It's called www.rumsfeld.com. And when I worked on the book, I spent 4 years on the book and decided to digitize a lot of my archive and create a website so people, if I quote a paragraph from a memorandum, a primary source document, someone can go to the website and actually pull up the full document and see the context of it. And the memo that's being referred to reflected on a reality that I think an awful lot of us don't think about, really. And it is that at the end of World War II, we were at an inflection point. And at the end of that war and the beginning of the Cold War. The Cold War, of course, went on for any number of decades. And during the Truman administration, a very large number of institutions were created. In the international area, you mentioned the UN and the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. the World Bank and the IMF, and I think in close proximity the OAS. Domestically, we also there were a number of institutions created, mechanisms. One was the Department of Defense. Previously, the three services had all gone off, and they didn't have the joint cooperative nature that really would value, bring out the value of true leverage and mm-hmm. jointness. The National Security Council was formed during that period of the Truman administration. The CIA was created. I think USIA was in close proximity to the Truman administration.
And your point was they really hadn't been updated since, right?
Well, the Pentagon is the one that has had the biggest change, mm-hmm. in my view. When they passed the Goldwater and Nichols legislation, they required that the military services not be in charge of operational forces, but instead organize, train, and equip the forces, and that the combatant commanders, which are all joint commands, would pull together people from all four services, and it created a vastly more effective military. But my point was that we reached another inflection point at the end of the Cold War and the beginning of the 21st century and the movement from the industrial age to the information age. And yet we really haven't looked at those institutions, either internationally or domestically.
And so you wrote this memorandum to the president, and how did he respond, Mr. Secretary?
Well, we talked about it, and he, I believe, had made decisions that we would go after the Taliban and al-Qaeda, and that he would change the regime, which had been in Iraq, which had been the policy of our government since the 1990s, when Congress nearly unanimously passed regime change, and President Clinton signed the legislation. And he set it aside, We never created a Hoover Commission type of organization that could take a bipartisan, serious look at those things.
Do you think one's still needed?
I do. I think it's needed badly. You know, if you take just the domestic, well, look at the international side. NATO was organized to deal with problems in the NATO treaty area. The problems that the NATO nations face today are problems that are largely outside of the NATO treaty area, meaning things like the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, the problems of piracy, all of those things require that NATO nations work with countries that aren't in NATO, and NATO doesn't have an effective, easy way of doing that. You think of the other free political systems and free economic systems like Japan and South Korea and Singapore and India and Australia and New Zealand. We would need to have NATO, they shouldn't be members of NATO, but there ought to be a way to link the NATO nations, other politically free nations, for the most part democracies, with other countries, other like-thinking countries.
So the president was just too preoccupied with so much else to really delve into what you had to say.
Yeah, he understood it.
The need continues.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And at home, the issues come up not in neat packages. Something comes up through the Department of State, it comes up through the intelligence community, it comes up through the Defense Department, it comes up from other departments of the government. And the National Security Council's task is to try to see that those threads go through a needlehead in a reasonably smooth way as they move towards the president. But the problem is these departments have different, they represent different institutions. They have different committees in Congress that oversee them and provide their funds, and they come straight up. They're not bent towards the president in any way that he can look at it in an orderly way. The Goldwater-Nichols legislation caused the Department of Defense to function in a dramatically different way. We need a Goldwater-Nichols for the executive branch of the federal government, and to do that, you have to have the Congress change the committee structure or change the reporting relationships and oversight relationships.
Let me just ask, as we began today, obviously being interrupted by protesters, this isn't the first time that's happened to you, Mr. Secretary. What do you make of it?
Well, I don't make a lot of it. I think that we've always had people protesting in our country. You go look at the Abraham Lincoln presidency, throughout time, I grew up in Chicago, and the hostility against Franklin Roosevelt during that period, and you think of the American firsters, which was Chicago was kind of a hotbed of that.
I wasn't around then, sir.
Well, I was. I have lived one-third of the history of our country, which is amazing. It says what a wonderful young country we have, or what an old man I am. Yeah. You multiply 79 times 3 and subtract the number from 2012, it takes you right back to the beginning of the country.
Let me turn to September 11th, 2001. You're in your office that day in the Pentagon, the building shakes, and America turns. How did you react to the plane hitting the Pentagon? What did you do?
I had just been meeting with a group of congressmen and having breakfast with them, and they had just departed, and we were told that a plane had hit the World Trade Center, so we knew there had been a terrible accident. And then it was not until the second plane hit the World Trade Center that it was clear it was not an accident. And I was with a CIA briefer at the moment when the plane hit the Pentagon, and I discontinued the briefing.
And in your book, you write, you went a-running.
I went down the hall, and it was filled with smoke, and someone came towards me and said, you can't go any farther inside. And so I went downstairs and went outside and around the building, and I ran into a lieutenant colonel who said he actually saw the plane hit the Pentagon. And so it was clear. I didn't know if it was a bomb or an airplane or what had happened, but there were none of the first responders there yet. It was too early, and there were people being taken out of the building who were injured and burned and bleeding. And there were a lot of military people and civilians going into the building to help people. And after a reasonably short period, I went back to my office and got on the phone with and George Tenet, the director of CIA, told me that they had information. It was very early in the morning still that in fact it was Al-Qaeda, that they had intercepted something that revealed the fact that it was certain that Al-Qaeda had masterminded the attack.
In some ways, you weren't surprised by what happened that day. You had just issued a warning of sorts in a meeting you were at with some of your colleagues in the Pentagon about something that could happen sometime soon. So you weren't entirely surprised.
Well, I would say I was surprised when the Pentagon was hit. I had my first brush with terrorism was when I was President Reagan's Middle East envoy. And 241 Marines and Navy corpsmen had been killed in Beirut at the airport. And he asked me to go over and work with the people in the Middle East and see what we could do. And I watched this process over the years where the Al-Qaeda attacked on the USS Cole, the original attack on the World Trade Center, which wasn't terribly successful, the attacks on our embassies, attacks in North Africa, the attack on the embassy in Beirut. And it became pretty clear that increasingly the world was facing radical Islamists who were determined to impose their will on nation states and people that didn't agree with them.
So you didn't anticipate an attack on the Pentagon per se, but you certainly were not stunned by an attack on the country that day.
No, after my time in the Middle East in the mid-80s, George Shultz and I both gave talks. I spoke to the U.S. Army Association and talked about the problem of terrorism. I mean, a terrorist can attack at any time, any place, using any technique, and it's not possible to defend it at every moment of the day and night against every conceivable technique in every place. It's just the attacker has an enormous advantage. And it was something that concerned me. I remember there was a senator from Kansas named Roberts.
Still around.
Still around. Mm-hmm. He was on the committee when I went up for my confirmation hearing in January of 2001 when President Bush asked me to come back to the government. He said to me, what do you worry about when you go to bed in the confirmation hearing? What bothers you about everything? And you know, you could have said Iran, you could have said North Korea, you could have said any number of things. And I said, I really worry about intelligence. Knowing what's happening and being, because we were moving into a different age. People around the world can take it. They don't have the ability to make the technological advances that are made in our country and other advanced countries, but they can take those technological advancements and use them against us, and they do. And I know that at the end of World War II, everyone kind of breathed a sigh of relief and said, gee, we can relax now. And then there was Korea, and there was Vietnam. Each time, everyone relaxed. At the end of the Cold War, the last 2 years of George Herbert Walker Bush, and the 8 years of the Clinton administration, that 10-year period, there were people who wrote books, that was the end of history. Well, it wasn't the end of history, as it turned out. And we cut back again. We hollowed out the intelligence community. We hollowed out the Pentagon. And we're about ready to make the same mistake again.
So did the intelligence community blow it, or was there just not enough of an intelligence community around to be aware of what was happening with al-Qaeda at that time?
You know, I hate to say that the intelligence committee blew it.
Yeah.
Because, by golly, now, did they...
Those are good words, though.
Yeah, that's, yeah, if you're a journalist.
Feel free.
But if I said it, it would suggest that their job was easy, that they'd been properly funded, and that we had the kind of human intelligence assets that are needed in the 21st century. And I think they had been hollowed out. And it's a lot easier to cut something than it is. It takes years to develop good human intelligence. And we've got a lot of wonderful people who work very hard on that. And it's, I tell you, that on my website also is an article by Tom Schelling, which is the foreword to a book by Roberta Wohlstetter on Pearl Harbor. And if you go on and read this thing, it is absolutely brilliant. He was written decades ago by this, I think he was a Harvard professor, Dr. Schelling. And he talks about the failure of imagination. First of all, we're dealing to, even when we were dealing with the Soviet Union, we could, for decades, we could look at it from overhead, we could find a lot of people who could help us understand what was going on, but we still didn't know.
Yeah.
Now we're dealing with not nations necessarily, but networks. We're dealing with governments that are closed, like North Korea and Iran, where it's very difficult to get access. We're dealing with people who operate in the shadows, and that's hard. That's hard stuff, and it's not one country. It's multiple locations, and it's a very difficult thing to do, so I wouldn't want to say they blew it, but it was a failure of imagination. I mean, think of Pearl Harbor. The fear was that there were a great many people of Japanese ancestry in Hawaii, and the risk was sabotage. So they stick all the airplanes close together so that they can guard them and watch them. And didn't imagine that they'd send their carriers. They were expecting the carriers to attack in the Pacific. And instead, the carriers came north and then south and launched these aircraft. And the easiest thing in the world to clean out all those airplanes. And all the battleships were lined up in a row. And they just, some of them, two abreast. And they took them out.
You know, in the months following 9/11, obviously the idea of going to war against Iraq began to blossom. You told Diane Sawyer, Mr. Secretary, that President Bush never asked you if going to war against Iraq was the right call or not. That really surprised me. What did you make of that?
She asked me if that was correct, because apparently President Bush said that, and I said yes. What do I make of it?
Yes, that he never asked you.
He never asked me, right.
But you're the Defense Secretary of the country. Why wouldn't he ask you?
Well, I don't know that he asked anybody. What he did do is say that at some point that he had decided that we ought to continue to put pressure on Saddam Hussein to comply with the 17 UN resolutions that he had refused to comply with. And he wanted us to start moving forces in that direction, and he hoped, as everyone hoped, that Saddam Hussein would acquiesce and cooperate with the United Nations. Turned out he didn't, because he was doing well with some of the countries in the United Nations. And the oil for food process wasn't oil for food. It was oil for anything Saddam wanted from two or three countries. And after the war, the UN had an investigation And it turned out that he was able to buy weapons. He was able to build his castles. He was able to get a lot of things besides food under the
Arrow. So you're saying the process just sort of began to gain momentum and go on its own.
Yeah.
At some point, should he have asked you?
As I say, he's the president. He was elected by the American people. He's the one who decides if something needs to be done. And he then tells Colin Powell, go to the UN. Let's see if we can get UN support. Let's Rumsfeld see if what the other countries around that region will do to cooperate
but
with
he
us.
He hired you because of your experience, vast experience in government.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, on a pivotal decision like this, one might think that he would ask someone like you.
What do you think,
Rummy? What do you think?
Yeah. Well, let's reverse it. He met regularly with me and with George Tenet and Colin Powell and Condi Rice and the senior military commanders, the Joint Chiefs and the combatant commanders. And any one of us had the opportunity to tell him he's doing something wrong.
And did you?
Did not.
Why not?
Because he proceeded in a very rational, logical way. The policy of the United States government was regime change in Iraq, been signed by President Clinton. The UN was being made a joke of by Saddam Hussein, being unwilling to do it. And even at the last minute, President Bush, we talked and tried to get Saddam Hussein to leave the country with his family and not have to go to war, change the regime, because he realized the pressure was great. The problem was Saddam Hussein in the first Gulf War, when it was over, and he was still there. George Herbert Walker Bush was defeated. Margaret Thatcher was having trouble marshaling support in England. And he stood up and said to the world, I fought the mother of all battles. And Bush is gone, and Thatcher's gone, and I'm here. And he had concluded that the United States was a paper tiger, that the United States wouldn't do anything to him.
But war is something very significant.
Oh, that's the understatement of the afternoon.
So who cares? So who cares if we're being called a paper tiger?
I'm just saying that that was his attitude. So he didn't. You're quite right on that. My point was not that. My point was that he had a lot of confidence that the United States wouldn't do anything. So as the pressure was built up, that forces were marshaled, the coalition was put together. I mean, President Bush's coalition was something like 90 nations in the war on terror.
So you never said, let's go to war. You never said, let's not go to war.
That's correct.
It just simply...
Well, no, but if I had disagreed, I would have resigned. In other words, if I had concluded he was making a terrible mistake, I would either you implement his decision or you leave.
So clearly you were comfortable with it. You stood behind it.
He was the president. He made that decision, and you bet your life I did, and so did everyone in his cabinet.
You know, weapons of mass destruction. Appearing on ABC's This Week, 2 weeks, Mr. Secretary, after the invasion in 2003, you said this: we know where the weapons of mass destruction are. Mm-hmm. They're in an area around Baghdad and east, west, south, and north somewhat. You were certain at that time that you knew where they were.
My language in that case was imperfect. And it was not the first time in my life. What we had was what the intelligence community gave us, and that was suspect sites. And the press was saying, well, where are the weapons of mass destruction stockpiles? And the intelligence community had concluded that they knew where these several suspect sites were.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of saying, we know where the suspect sites are and we're still south of them, I said, we know where they are in my mind, meaning the suspect sites, and we're not there yet. We were still coming up from the south, our forces were.
I mean, that's a tough thing to have imperfect language about, because the country, the decision seemed to be weighing at that moment anyway, so much on, are WMDs there or not?
Mm-hmm.
And if the answer is no, the country might have been in a different place in terms of backing that war at that moment.
Well, I don't know that I quite follow that, but the
people were relying on people like you to give a clear sense of what you knew about something as important as WMDs. You're saying your language was imperfect at that moment. Why not clarify shortly after so that
I did.
People could understand?
It just didn't get the press coverage that the earlier comment did. Colin Powell had dealt with intelligence matters probably more than anyone in the government. He spent his whole career. He was National Security Advisor for President Reagan. He was Chairman of the Chiefs. He was Secretary of State. They had an intelligence element there. He spent days and days and days preparing his presentation to the United Nations. That presentation was the basis for the president's decision. And Powell did not lie. George Bush did not lie. It immediately transformed in Bush lied, people died. And that was an ugly, inaccurate, unfortunate thing. And Powell did not lie. He worked very hard on that, and he was an intelligent man, and he knew that business. And he went up to the UN and presented to the world that case. It was agreed to by the intelligence agencies in England, in France, in other countries.
But there was division
just a minute,
at that time.
Just a minute. And same information went up to the Congress and to the intelligence committees. And the senior Democrats, as well as the Republicans, agreed. One of them, the head of the Intelligence Committee, I think, said the threat is imminent. I mean, you had Rockefeller, you had Kerry, you had Hillary Clinton, all these senators saying that they saw the intelligence and they agreed with it. Now, what actually turned out to be the case? First of all, the reason that President decided to go to war was not simply weapons of mass destruction. There was a long list of things that the Congress passed in a resolution. I don't know, 15 things or something that were listed. Then the question is, well, what was there? Well, you had a man who had rejected 17 UN resolutions. He had used chemical weapons against his own people. He had used chemical weapons against his neighbor in Iran. Everyone knew he had chemical weapons. Our forces were so convinced he had them. Every neighboring country said, but when you get close to Baghdad, Saddam Hussein will use chemical weapons against your troops. So what did the troops do? They put on chemical protective things. Mm-hmm. You're not your first choice. Then afterwards, did they find stockpiles of weapons of mass destruction? As you point out, no. What did they find? The Delfer report, a former UN inspector, went in. The report's available. And he found that they had dual-use facilities that could make some non-lethal things and lethal things and could be converted in a matter of days. He said that they had all the precursors they needed because they already knew how to do it and had done it in the past and used it on people. And he said that they still had the people who did it together. And it would take a matter of weeks to redevelop these stockpiles.
Mr. Secretary, though, it was the threat against this country that Hussein might be aggressive with these WMDs and come after us that I think was a factor in really pushing the American people to say, yes, we need to take this step. I'm just wondering, as you sit here today and you look back at this unanimity you describe, which wasn't quite unanimous, but it was down that road.
Pretty close.
In the official community, how wrong we were. And what do you make of that today, looking back now?
Well, I guess what you do is you say that intelligence is never perfect. It's often contradictory, conflicting, and frequently wrong. And you have to live with that. What does that mean for a president? It means your margin for error is relatively modest. If you go back into the early part of my life, the lethality of weapons compared to today was relatively modest. Mm-hmm. In the 40s, nuclear weapons were used for the first time, and the lethality of weapons changed. They, amazingly, have not been used in anger since. And then you get to the point where 3,000 people are killed in America. At that moment, the President of the United States and the U.S. government had a study called Dark Winter. It had been created by a study group at Johns Hopkins, mostly of the prior administration's former senior officials. And they theorized smallpox being put in three locations in America. And within a year, 1 million Americans, they concluded, would be dead. Now, 1 million Americans dead, not with a nuclear weapon. So suddenly you're living in a time and an era where you know there are terrorist networks, you know there are nations that have weapons of mass destruction, and you know that you could think of our freedoms if you had the smallpox hit our country today. Think of the martial law. You'd have to do. States wouldn't prep. They wouldn't allow people to move across borders. The quarantines. It would be a whole way of life would change. Yeah. And I'm coming to a conclusion. I'm sorry that it takes so long, but it's important. One, people understand an act of defense. Japanese attack Pearl Harbor, and we respond. Roosevelt went to the Congress, got a declaration of war against Japan, and then he declared war against Germany that had not attacked us. And that was not an act of defense. That was an act of, some would say, preemption. Mm-hmm. Another might try to find some phrases such as anticipatory self-defense. In other words, you had a sense you were going to be attacked, and because of the danger of it, you acted before that. Now, if you're looking at the Dark Winter study, and you just had 3,000 people lost in America, the worst attack ever, then the president, does he wait to be attacked, or does he decide that anticipatory self-defense, given the lethality of weapons and the risk we'd just taken, and the reality of things like the Dark Winter study. So it because of the lethality of weapons, a president's margin for error is quite modest.
Now, given the results of this war, has this notion of a preemptive strike in the future taken a big hit here because of the way this war came out and the fact that WMDs, in fact, were not there?
I guess time will tell. I've always found putting yourself in someone else's shoes and trying to imagine what the world looked like to them is a useful thing to do. Put yourself in the shoes of a president 8 years from now. We don't know who it is, but somebody's there. And he's faced with the Dark Winter scenario. And the risk-benefit ratio, the cost-benefit ratio. And he sees the potential threat of 1 million Americans could be killed. And he has reason to believe that some sort of preemptive action, anticipatory self-defense, might prevent that. Tough calls. I mean, think how you'd feel about it. Think how any of us would. It's a god-awful thing.
You're referring to President Romney or Santorum?
No, I said 8 years.
Well, that might get you there.
You're not going to walk me down that road.
You know, at the time, Mr. Secretary, you said this to the troops in Italy in February 2003, just a month before the invasion. You said this, and it is not knowable, referring to your book title, I guess, if force will be used, but if it is to be used, it is not knowable how long that conflict will last. It could last, 6 days, 6 weeks, I doubt 6 months. How could you be so wrong?
Well, major combat operations was less than 6 months, in answer to your question. But what I've said repeatedly, and if you go and look me up on the website, you'll see that I have said over and over and over again that it is not possible to know the length of a war, it's not possible to know the cost of a war, and it's not possible to know the number of lives that will be lost. All you can know is that there will be lives lost, and it is expensive, and that it is unpredictable. And speculating about that is impossible. And I said that to the Congress in testimony after testimony.
Let's talk about the surge, or the lack of a surge. You opted to cut troops in Iraq rather than add to them. You write this in the book, Mr. Secretary, in retrospect, there may have been times more troops could have been useful. What were you thinking there in terms of not adding troops at that time? Why cut troops instead of add to them and attempt to end the war maybe earlier?
Mm-hmm. Well, my approach to it, and whether it's right or wrong, I guess people have different views of it, but my approach to it was that the military leadership would be making decisions with respect to numbers of troops. And General Franks and his successor, General Abizaid, made those decisions. And they made recommendations to me, and I supported their decisions. And they made recommendations to the president, and he supported those decisions.
And they weren't saying, let's send in lots more forces right now.
There was never an instance where a combatant commander asked for more forces that they didn't get them. Now, we're in instances where they did ask, and they did get them. We surged three or four times in Iraq. When elections were coming, or if there was some particular problem, they'd kick up the numbers, 10, 15, 20,000, and they would do it basically by lagging some people who were due to leave, or trying to bring in some people earlier, and then holding some people longer, so you could surge or bulge your total number of forces. But there was never an instance where a combatant commander asked for additional troops that they didn't get it. The tension there is a real one. And I agreed with the combatant commanders. The reason the surge in 06 was helpful was the following. Number one, the Iraqi security forces by then were in the hundreds of thousands. They'd been trained, they'd been equipped, and it took a long time to do that. As a matter of fact, that's one of the problems with our institutions. The Department of State was in charge of military things like that, and that needs to be changed.
They were able to help you at that point.
Absolutely. The Iraqi forces were able to be helpful. Second, the Maliki government had matured. He had gotten some steel up him, and they'd gone down in south and gone after some insurgents in the south, in the Shia area, mm-hmm. and done a good job on it. Third, the Sunni awakening occurred. The Sunnis in the early stages of the Iraq war stayed out. They didn't vote in the elections, and they end up suffering for it. They were hospitable to al-Qaeda. And the Sunnis, of course, the prior government, Saddam Hussein, was a Sunni government mm-hmm. in a Shia majority country. And the Sunnis didn't want the Shias to govern the country, and with a vote, they very likely would get more votes. So they stayed away and wouldn't play, and they cooperated with al-Qaeda. They got to the point where their families were being raped and beaten. Their businesses were being taken. They had a belly full of al-Qaeda, and they turned on them. So those three things all came together at the moment when the president made the right decision to add some troops and keep them in Baghdad.
You know, speaking of the president, your boss, the president, called that decision, this call to draw down troops after the 2003 invasion of Iraq, the most important failure in the execution of the war. That's his writing out of his book.
A drawdown of troops
yes.
in when, 03?
To not surge was the single biggest mistake of the war. What's your reaction to that?
I guess we'll never know. The road not traveled is always smoother.
Mm-hmm. But the president certainly could have overruled your recommendations, the recommendations of the generals,
of course,
and surged then if he had wanted to.
Oh, absolutely, if he had thought that would be a good idea. General Franks had left by then, and General Abizaid was the combatant commander for Central Command. And there's no question but that a lot of advice affected everybody, the president, me, Abizaid. Every neighboring country said, look, fine. Saddam Hussein's a brutal dictator. Go in, get rid of him, but don't stay there a long time. They said, it is not good. We're going to have trouble in the so-called Arab street if we see bombs dropped on Muslims and it looks like you're trying to occupy the country and take their oil. So do what you have to do. Get rid of Saddam Hussein. Take that brutal regime out. But do not leave him in place. After the earlier Gulf War, they had supported us, and Saddam Hussein was still there. You can imagine what their relationships with Saddam Hussein were. And they didn't like him. They didn't want him there. And so Abizaid's recommendations were, look, let's keep as light a hand as we can. And I think the suggestion that someone knows what would have been the case is a reach. I doubt it. I don't know. I know I don't know what might have. If Abizaid had said, "Gee, let's add troops
earlier."
Earlier, yeah. The Sunnis were still outside the tent. Maliki's government was pitiful. It was very weak for a long time. And it's been growing strong. And we didn't have Iraqi security forces in the numbers. So I guess I don't know. I know I don't know.
Let's turn to Abu Ghraib.
That's a known unknown.
Yes, known and unknown, yes. The prisoner abuses at Abu Ghraib, Mr. Secretary, you called them a punch in the gut.
Oh, it was terrible.
Maybe it's obvious, but why?
Well, you know, what we had was hundreds of thousands of wonderful young men and women serving in the armed forces of the United States. Everyone there was a volunteer. Everyone was they came to those jobs and those activities, which are dangerous and risky, and put their lives at risk on behalf of our country. And the images, the photographs of the people at Abu Ghraib on that midnight shift, mm-hmm. abusing people that were in our custody, was so disgusting and so revolting and sadistic and un-American. And it tarnished the men and women in uniform, because people saw American people who were supposed to be treating them. The president said to treat them humanely. I said treat them humanely. And it left So it not only tarnished the military, but it did something else. It gave fodder and encouragement to the enemy. They could go out and use that to raise money. They could use that to gain recruits. These terrible, terrible people are doing these god-awful things. And it just broke my heart to see that people were doing that. It turns out that every person who was involved in it was prosecuted, and to the extent they were guilty, they were punished. And they should have been. But the big misunderstanding about it was there was an implication that those people were engaged in interrogation. And, of course, that was not the case. Mm-hmm. These were not interrogators. These were guards.
Well,
they were prison
about...
guards. And the people they were abusing were not subjects of interrogation. They were just people they were detaining.
That's right. Let me ask about that, though. In December of 2002, now this is 4 or 5 months before we go to war in Iraq, before we invade, you changed what military interrogators were allowed to do to some detainees. Acting on the recommendation of Pentagon attorneys, you approved, quote, the removal of clothing and using detainees' phobia, such as dogs, to induce stress. You refused to approve waterboarding, but I'm wondering, did you set the table, perhaps, in an atmospheric kind of way for the abuses that then followed? Mm-hmm.
Well, apparently not, because there were 12 different investigations, and not a single investigation suggested that was the case. Some were done by military personnel. Some were done by former Secretary of Defense Harold Brown, former Secretary of Defense Jim Schlesinger, and they concluded that was not the case. Just to explain what he's referring to, the individual, there was those enhanced interrogation techniques. A limited number were recommended by the combatant commander in Southcom, the head of the Guantanamo Bay, and it came up through the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the chairman, and then to the General Counsel, and they came in, and General Counsel and the leadership of the Department of Defense recommended that some be approved and some be disapproved, and I agreed. The person they were approved for was one person, just one person. Not anyone at Guantanamo, and not anyone anywhere else in the world, certainly not at Abu Ghraib. It was mm-hmm. it was for a man named Katani. And Katani had been stopped at the Tampa airport, as I recall. And he was then refused entry, and he decided to go back into Pakistan or Afghanistan. He was there, scooped up on the battlefield. And there was absolutely no question in people's mind but that he was the 20th hijacker. There were four planes. Each was to have five people. The two planes that hit the World Trade Center had five people. Right. The one that hit the Pentagon had five people. And the one that the courageous passengers overcame, the terrorists, mm-hmm. crashed in Pennsylvania, had four. Mm-hmm. And Kadani was the 20th hijacker. And there was no question but that they concluded down there that he had information that would be helpful and could save American lives. What happened was they sent up the recommendation. I turned down a variety of things, including waterboarding and what have you. He then was interrogated. What happens is if you're approved certain techniques, then there has to be an interrogation plan. And the combinations and duration of the interrogation techniques can take authorized techniques and turn them into a behavior pattern that is not humane. And at some point up the side, the Judge Advocate General side, some people said they were worried about the way it was being handled, the interrogation plan, not the techniques, but the interrogation plan. It came up, General Counsel told me, I said, immediately rescinded the order. And I said, okay, let's find out what they're worried about. They pulled them all together, they talked to them, and they then came in with their recommendations. And they came in with a number of recommendations, and I accepted only the recommendations for enhanced interrogation techniques that were approved unanimously. And they went through the Joint Chiefs of Staff and everybody else. And then that was reissued. And the information that was attained was valuable. And the idea that a bunch of non-interrogators in another country would take things that had been authorized for one person, mm-hmm. and later some of them were authorized for a second person, Kitani, and then there was a man named Sali or something like that. And but I think the answer is no. I think that's not likely.
Mr. Secretary, April of 2006, we're fast-forwarding here just a little bit. This is the so-called General's Revolt. Six retired generals went public to criticize you, and they said you didn't listen to the advice of the military, just contrary to what you said a few minutes ago about listening to your commanders in Iraq in terms of how much force they needed at that time. What was your reaction to that event?
Oh, goodness. You know, that's not unusual for some people who were unhappy.
But six.
Oh, you know how many retired generals and admirals there are? Do you?
No. But six.
Somebody. Listen, there are so many retired admirals and generals floating around this country. Six is very modest. And
You didn't take it seriously.
I take everything seriously if it's presented in a thoughtful way and there's substance to it. In this case, I think I had met maybe one of them or two of them. I've never worked with any of them. They had no reason to know anything about how I work. And I think that the more pointed criticism of me would be just the opposite. If someone wants to critique it, they could say, well, you shouldn't have taken the advice of the... You listened too carefully. You should not have taken their advice, which is the backside of what you said about the surge. And I think that there are people who don't get the jobs they want, they don't get the promotions they want, they are unhappy for some reason, or they heard something, and so they fuss. I never went home wringing my hands and said, oh my goodness gracious, isn't that terrible?
I'm going to ask a few more questions here. If any of you in the audience want to ask a question, there are a pair of microphones here. Come on down, I'll be able to try and see you through the light here, and we can ask a couple more. Mr. Secretary, you turned in resignation letters not once to President Bush, but twice. But the president refused to accept them. Was that the right call on his part? Because you write about this.
I do. I wrote in the book about it. I think not. I believe in accountability. And as fate would have it, I was presiding over the Pentagon when Abu Ghraib took place. And it seemed to me that My problem was there are two chains down. One from the command chain goes from the president to the secretary to the Gabatin commander, and then down to the commander in that country, and then down to the person who's in charge of that prison. The administrative chain goes from the president to the secretary, and then down through the service chiefs, service secretaries and service chiefs, and then down a different line. As fate would have it, the people on both chains who had real responsibility were no longer there. I had fired the Secretary of the Army earlier, who had been there. The Army had the job of organizing training and equipping the trainers. Obviously, they weren't organized or trained properly, and they weren't being supervised properly if they're doing that at the midnight shift. It wasn't like there were five shifts doing it. There was one shift doing it. And he was gone. Below him, the chief of staff of the Army who'd been there during that period, he had retired, General Shinseki. You go down the other line, General Franks had left, and Abizaid was relatively new. And the one person who was there in the command chain who had normally you would say, if you were going to hold someone accountable, it would have been the commander in Iraq. It turned out that General Sanchez, I think, was not well served by the United States Army. He was one of our youngest division people. He was moved up to be in charge of the country. Oh, that's too bad.
Ah, shoot.
Is there a doctor?
Is there a doctor in the house by any chance? Okay, we're there. Okay, good.
Should I go on?
Yeah, why don't we?
Yeah.
Why don't we? Yeah.
And down the command chain, this general was the most junior division commander. I was amazed that he had been given the job. And he had not been properly staffed up by the Army. And that's a common problem in the military. We don't have the kinds of joint task forces to do jobs. And the result was that his... I'm trying to think if he was probably staffed up about 73%, something like that. And the joint staff had not forced it. We told them to staff them up. The Army had not done it. And I think it would have been unfair to him to hold him accountable. And I looked around and there wasn't anyone else except me. So I went to the president and handed him a letter of resignation and said that... I believe in accountability, and I think the Pentagon will be better off if you have a change. I think you'll be better off, the armed services, the military will, and I think the administration and the country will. That it is a good thing for a country when something terrible happens like that, and in my view it was terrible, that somebody be seen as being accountable for it and be gone. So I gave my resignation letter. He said, the next day he came back and said, no, that isn't the answer. And about a week later, I went back to him and handed him a letter and said he's wrong and that I should go. And he, oh gosh, he took a day or two and came back and said, I've thought about it and I just think you're wrong. And I wrote in my book that I think I'm right.
Let's go to some audience members here with questions for Secretary Rumsfeld. Yes, sir.
Mr. Secretary, first of all, thank you for your service as a former intel officer. I empathize with your comments when policy and intel come together. It's not always a pretty picture. Just a quick question. One of the terms that came out of the administration during your time was asymmetric warfare. Mm-hmm. I know Congressman Skelton has written on that topic. Mm-hmm. We teach that at the staff college. I know you were just there this morning.
I was. I enjoyed it.
And we were glad to have you. Could you comment on the utility of that concept of asymmetric warfare, and is it still applicable, and what's your advice on how to deal with the future of conflict, given the examples that you lived through and what you're seeing today?
Well, thank you. If you think about it, the Department of Defense is largely organized, trained, and equipped to fight navies, fight armies, and fight air forces. And the United States of America is not currently being contested by large armies, navies, or air forces. We are, however, being challenged by terrorist networks and rogue states and the risk of the proliferation of dangerous and highly lethal weapons. And the question is, how do you deal with those things? And it's very different than fighting a major battle with a navy or an army or an air force. And it worries me that we don't do it very well. If you think about it, the Cold War was sure, there were hot elements of hot war in Latin America and in Africa and different places. But it lasted decades, and it was really more of a competition of ideas. And those ideas had to be combated. You had to identify what the problem was, what the enemy was, and it was communism, and it was command economies and dictatorial political systems and aggressiveness on the part of the Soviets. And so you had to compete against that. And we had a wonderful thing going for us. We had the fact that free systems work better, and political command economies and dictatorial systems don't work as well. And anyone looking down from Mars on Earth knows that the people who have opportunities are the ones living in freer systems. Now, the problem we've got here is different. The problem is that if someone wants to ask me in a press conference, and I probably shouldn't have said it, but they asked me what kind of a grade would we give the United States government, our administration, then, on our ability to communicate and compete with a battle of ideas. And I said, well, I'm an easy grader, and I'd give us a D. We just don't do it well. We find it awkward, and I'd give this administration something less than that, worse than a D, because they're even reluctant to identify the enemy or to talk about it. Now, everyone, and certainly President Bush and everyone in that administration, as well as this administration, is very reluctant to be seen as against a religion. We don't want to be, because we're not against a religion. What we're against is an element within that religion that is trying to hijack the religion and trying to persuade the rest of the people in that religion that it is in their interest to kill innocent men, women, and children and try to impose their way of life on others and try to end the concept of nation states. Now, so what is asymmetric warfare? I'd give the Bush administration and this administration high marks for forming coalitions, notwithstanding the fact that some partisans called President Bush a unilateralist, which is nonsense. I mean, my goodness, we had 90 nations in the counter global war on terror coalition. There were dozens of countries in Iraq coalition and in the Afghan coalition. To try to be negative about those coalitions. Our theory was that the mission had to determine the coalition, and the coalition ought not to determine the mission. And it seems to me that we don't do well at that yet. We need to do a whale of a lot better. And we are going to be faced with asymmetric problems that are going to require asymmetric responses. And that means we're going to have vastly better intelligence. We're going to have to link the availability of power with diplomacy. And we're going to have to thank the good Lord that we've got special operations forces and that they've been dramatically increased in number and their skill sets and their authorities and that they serve our country brilliantly.
Yes, sir.
My name is Nathan Reeb, and I'm a student at William Jewell College. It's an honor to get to talk to you, Secretary Rumsfeld.
Thank you very much.
You said that the main purpose of the 2003 Iraq War and during the Iraq War, after the first Iraq War, that the purpose was to get Saddam Hussein and have regime change in Iraq, right?
That's what the Congress passed. That's what the President said.
Right, and there were several operations between the wars for humanitarian intervention, and I'm just wondering how much the 2003 war, how much the purpose of that war was humanitarian intervention.
I suppose it's in the mind of the decider, the president, and the Congress. And if one goes back and looks at the congressional testimony and the hearings and the resolutions passed by Congress and the president's speeches, there was the president talked about freedom and democracy, and if you include that in humanitarian, which I would, it was clearly part of it. I don't know that I'd want to assign weighting to it. I think overwhelmingly it was the reality that that regime was a brutal regime and a dangerous regime, and less the other.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
A couple more. Yes, ma'am.
Hi. I'm also a student, and thank you very much for coming to talk to us today.
Thank you.
For better or for worse, I'm much shorter. For better or for worse, our image of as America abroad after the war has changed. A lot of theorists are saying that this is the beginning of the decline of the United States. How, in our future military endeavors, do we repair the image that we acquired after Abu Ghraib, after those controversial actions? How do we move forward and really restore the glorified American values that are so central to our position in the world?
You know, if you go back in history and think of World War II, the scooping up of Japanese Americans and putting them in detention centers was widely criticized and hurt our country, in a sense. You go back to the Vietnam War and the My Lai and the things that occurred that were more recently in I think it was Afghanistan, the units that killed some people. A striker unit. There are these things. I think to parse out your question, your question was a good one, but it left kind of an impression that we used to be well thought of and we aren't. And that just isn't the case. We have always gone through situations in our country, and the people across the globe are still... If you go to almost any embassy anywhere in the world, American embassy, today, at 10 or 11 at night, there are going to be people sleeping in the grass trying to get a visa to come to this country. They want to be here. Why? Because of the opportunity, because of the freedoms. I think that it would be wrong to assume that we went from here to here. It's more like this. And there are always going to be criticisms of the biggest country in terms of its military or its economy. There are going to be people who would like to have some other leader in the world community. But the reality is there isn't another country that's going to be able to contribute the kind of stability and security that the United States provides in the world. If the United States weren't there, that vacuum would be filled. And it would be filled by people who think differently, who may have appetites to take other people's real estate or other people's resources. And that everyone in the world knows that's not the United States, that we do not go somewhere to take their land. We don't go somewhere to take their oil. And we have to make sure we don't. So I think what we need to do is to recognize that we have as history evolved, the United States of America has a role that's an important one. It's a role as an example. I mean, look at what's going on in the Middle East today. You've got, 40, 50, 60% of young men under 35 unemployed in a lot of those countries. They see television, they see Facebook, they see Twitter, they see movies, and they think, my goodness, look at the opportunity in other countries, and we don't have that. And this country is the prime example of freedom and opportunity. Perfect? No. you know, but I'd put some balance into it.
Maybe. Let's do one more from the audience, and I have one more quick one, then we're going to wrap up here. Yes, sir.
Okay. Again, thank you for coming to speak to us, Mr. Secretary. I was wondering, as someone who has been in the unfortunate position of having to decide where enhanced interrogation is necessary, what circumstances do you believe justify this type of interrogation, given the varying reliability of evidence and the difficulties of intel?
Well, I don't know how well I can answer that. I mean,
20 words or less.
That'll be the day. If I ask this audience how many people were waterboarded at Guantanamo, the answers would range from 100 to 50. Someone might think 3. And the answer is 0. Not 1. How many people were waterboarded by the men and women in the military? Not 1.
In training.
Oh, that's different. You're quite right. They do use enhanced interrogation techniques on our own people to prepare them to be able to, if they're captured, and that gentleman who just spoke is, I think you're a former Special Services officer,
that's
Special
correct.
Forces. God bless you. Thank you. But but the men and women in the armed forces really aren't trained to do that enhanced interrogation techniques to any great extent, and that's why the Central Intelligence Agency had people who were capable of doing that, and they did it to 3 people, and so the reason I rejected a lot of those techniques was because our people simply aren't trained to do it. That isn't what we ought to be doing. The president made a decision that there were certain people, not a lot, and 3 were waterboarded, who had so much information, potentially, that he was willing to go to the Department of Justice, ask what was legal, got a legal opinion from the Department of Justice saying it was okay to do what he did, tell the Central Intelligence Agency to do it. And they did. And they briefed the Congress, and the senior members of the Congress and the Intelligence Committee approved. Now, why did they do that? Well, he did it because he was absolutely concerned that these people had information that would help protect the American people. I must say, the criticism of the CIA and the people who did the interrogations, I think, was unfair. The president made the decision. He had a legal opinion from the Department of Justice that it was a legal thing to do. And not one of the people who suffered from waterboarding was permanently injured or killed in any way. I mean, compared to a drone attack killing somebody, the 3 people that were waterboarded, we've had 4 or 5 CIA directors appointed by a Democrat president and Republican presidents who have successively stood up and told the press that, in fact, the information that came from those 3 people constituted a major fraction of what we learned about Al-Qaeda and helped to protect the American people. So I can't fault President Bush for making the decision, and I certainly can't fault the interrogators or the Central Intelligence Agency for doing what they did. I'm not able to formulate an answer that would be any better than you put yourself in a president's shoes and think what you would do. I mean, one of a very prominent Democrat senator from a state that was, I guess I can say it was New York, actually, you know, said, by golly, if millions of people's lives are threatened, we ought to darn well do what we need to do to protect them. And if anyone had told me 10 years ago that the United States would not suffer another major attack in a decade, I wouldn't have believed it. And there were a lot of important structures put in place that were highly criticized, let there be no doubt. Military commissions, the indefinite detention, the Patriot Act. President Obama campaigned against all of them. Here he is, 3 years in office. They're all there. Why are they there? Well, I have no doubt but that you get in office and it's different than campaigning for office. And you look at those things, and he looked at those things and said, by golly, it's my job as commander-in-chief to protect the American people. I don't like them. Well, we didn't like them either. Yeah. But by golly, trashing them and running the risks that the not 3,000, 30,000, 300,000 Americans might be killed. Presidents don't like to do that.
You know, just a final thing to wrap up on.
Oh, I hope it's a good question.
It is. From looking, they've all been good.
Don't give me a five-part question either.
This is
I'm an old man and I'm tired.
No, we're wrapping up. One thing that struck me about the book that I had forgotten about from 1970s history, Mr. Secretary, is how close you came to sitting here today and me addressing you as Mr. President. Because in 72, 73, when Spiro Agnew resigned, you were on the short list to become vice president under Richard Nixon. And then when President Gerald Ford ascended to the White House, you were once again on the short list to become vice president. How close did you get?
I think the closest was with President Reagan.
Later on?
Yeah, later on. I was one of three. And he, at the last minute, there was this strange thing where they started talking about Gerald Ford being vice president to Ronald Reagan.
Yes. Super
and,
team.
Yeah, well, they called it a co-presidency, mm-hmm. which I thought was a mindless idea. And President Reagan called me up and said, Don, I've decided to go with George Herbert Walker Bush for my vice president. And I said, thank goodness. Because I was afraid he was going to go for Gerald Ford, and I didn't think that would be... Four hands on the steering wheel is a good way to put the truck in a ditch. And I didn't think it would be good for my friend President Ford, and I didn't think it would be good for President Reagan. And I was very relieved. And you know what he said to me? He said, oh, no, Don. Jerry and I agreed it wouldn't be a good idea. He didn't want me to think that he had decided it. He wanted to give Jerry Ford credit. It was an enormously gracious thing to say. And he was a wonderful, gracious man.
I should point out that proceeds from the sale of Secretary Rumsfeld's book are going to various military charities, and just so you're aware of that. And
so buy one for your Christmas card list.
Yeah. Get that. Mike?
Okay, well, Secretary Rumsfeld, we're honored to have you with us again today. I mentioned in the introduction that you had the second longest tenure of any Secretary of Defense. I suspect in the tenure you had, your degree of difficulty must be up there among the top as well, and we appreciate the honesty and candor with which you've addressed us today, and we look forward to having you visit us again sometime soon.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.